I'm thinking that maybe that's a pretty long stretch, and I don't think some people might want to talk afterwards. I'm thinking maybe we go for until 3 and then see where we're at, see if we want to go longer. Is that a good? I mean, I think we may well, but I think maybe we'll have reached some definitive conclusions.
It will all be resolved by
the presence of philosophers. So my idea in organizing this last session was
to, in part, cover some of the topics that were not covered by the speakers. And I think some of these topics, well, I'm sure now that some of these topics are of interest to people, but that nobody felt really prepared to speak on, in particular about the role of mathematics. So I say that, so we had 3 topics on the original list having to do with the role of mathematics, only one of which, 10, was really I'm not sure about this, but I would say that only 10 was really touched on in the talks so far, 9 and 11. And then several of the proposals from yesterday also had to do with this. One, this is on the back of your list, is does saying no to 11, so reference to 11, presuppose that laws must be dynamical? 3, can logic be enough to specify that there are laws of nature without specifying exactly what the laws are? So there's some laws that, this is if we don't take mathematics logic to be a part of mathematics, we might say that there are some laws that are purely logical and thus not mathematical in nature. And another recent contribution to this, can there be laws that are not differential equations? I think I could organize a little bit of a discussion on that. We'd like that to be one of the people are interested in talking about this, I take it. Okay, I'll say a few words and then get something going, but let's see what else. Would anybody like to nominate something from this list? I think it can be, there are several questions on the limits of law and the role of law in explanation. And there are, there are a few, I would say 4, 5, 6, 7 have to do with whether or not there are laws at all, or there are things that deserve to be called laws, and I think this would tie in somewhat to John Roberts' first talk on what the nature of laws, what is a law. So whether or not there are laws, of course, depends on what you mean by law. So that's a topic, and then there are a couple that don't really fit into any particular category. I would say 2, 8, and 9, to what extent is it possible to understand the laws of physics as consequences of inferential procedure? 8, might there be multiple sets of equally good ways? This is a question about underdetermination. Equally good ways of representing the laws of nature. 9, is there reason to think that laws of nature are unified? This is a perennial among philosophers of science. And
do you have extra copies of this? Actually?
Oh, I do have a couple, I think. Yes. You didn't get one?
I think that's the first one.
Right. Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah. I think I've exhausted my copies. So, Sabine, this is your. Well, you can take yours back if you like it. Hand that back to me. So, and nominations for. So, we'll talk a bit about mathematics and the laws of physics and the role of mathematics. Other things. You can nominate your own.
I'd rather like number 7.
You like number 7?
Might there not be laws at all?
Okay.
I don't want to comment on it, but I like it.
Right. Anybody else, have a liking for number 7? So,
imagine John Wheeler were here. What would he say?
Right. Good. All right. This is like, what would Jesus say?
Right.
Anybody? Well, okay. So number seven is a possibility.
I can imagine my Nancy Cartwright.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. That's right, but she...
We tried to get her.
Chris...
We begged.
Chris flew
we
to England.
We offered money.
And tried to...
Big money.
Yeah, big
money. That's just what we're paying you.
Right. let's see. Number seven. And there's several things here on... Actually, there aren't that many.
So number eight, I'd like to nominate.
Eight, multiple sets, so under determination. Okay, and that will raise the question, I think, of what counts. What counts as two different sets of laws versus two different representations of the same law? Mm-hmm. Which, yeah, okay, good. Yes, Janine. Okay.
Is it too late to sort of ask a new question?
No.
Probably connects a lot, I think, to some of the things that Julian was talking about, which is there's something that philosophers ignore, which is constraints on the phenomena that emerge not from laws, but from the kind of compositional structure of reality. If you say what the basic elements are, and you presuppose a kind of combinatorial theory of possibility, say, well, given these basic elements, what are the configurations that the universe
right.
can assume? Those impose quite strong constraints on the phenomena, and different choices impose different constraints. You'll get different ideas of what the possible configurations are from those. And I'd be interested in hearing what motivates choices of basic elements and how much work that does relative to the laws and in sort of explanation.
I see. So it would be something like, do we start with a configuration space, a phase space, a geometric object? Is that it, or is it the emphasis? The principles of combination. That's the other aspect.
Once you give the ontology, I mean, sort of in a Newtonian universe, you say the basic building blocks are these, and you get descriptions of possible universes, even before you add the dynamics by saying, mm-hmm. you know, what are the ways of recombining those things to generate, you know, sort of pictures of reality, and then use the laws to kind of pick out possible trajectories. Right? But what the choices of the basic elements are will place quite constraints on what configurations.
Sure. Okay, good. Julian, you want
to... I just wanted to confirm. Yes, and the interesting thing is the choice of the ontology in many ways suggests perhaps nearly uniquely the law, or at least the simplest law, and it quite well defines that this is precisely what is happening in relativity as a dynamical theory or as a four-dimensional space-time theory. The Einstein-Hilbert action is the simplest... I think by any criteria, the Einstein-Hilbert action is the simplest one that satisfies the ontology that Einstein started with. So that's very constraining.
Right, and it seems like the direction of theorizing, or the direction of development of theory, would be if we could have the ontology so tightly constrained the laws that we almost wouldn't need the laws.
That's my conjecture when we've got that.
Well, this is related to the extent to which logic or laws of inference constrain.
I'm going to leave some comment on that direction.
Okay, so why don't we leave some time for that? Seven, let me just write it down. White is. Like there be no true regularities. And this is sort of related, I think, to, as I can tell, to Roberto and Lee's idea. Unfortunately, they had to leave. Okay, theirs is a universe in which...
Maybe I should retract it.
Yeah.
Because they were the ones who should have commented.
Well, we could say anything we want because they're not here. But they might watch the video.
If you are there, you must assign something.
Multiple.
What is ontology?
What is ontology? This always comes up, right?
That's what means. I wonder if that means building block.
Stuff. It means stuff. All right, let's start with mathematics.
Thing
means thing, not stuff.
I think it's not what there is. It's what there is.
What there is.
Okay. Well, it's more. Okay.
I think the practical definition is if you use it, then you're a philosopher. If you don't use it, then you're a physicist.
It's made its way into the quantum foundation.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Rob, I think you introduced the word ontic. Right?
Ontic is a
Yeah.
I'm
not ontological.
There's just so many extra syllables you don't need.
That's true. That's true. Okay, that's all framework stuff. We can fill that in as need be. So the idea, one of the ideas behind the question about the role of mathematics is sort of twofold. One is does physics have to be, or is reality, I don't know how to phrase this, does physics have to be fundamentally mathematical? So, I mean, I wrote down a piece of paper, three examples of arguably non-mathematical science, and this will no doubt spark a discussion on what we mean by mathematical. Aristotelian physics, geology, evolutionary biology, arguably non-mathematical. And there's kind of a related question you could ask, well, okay, given that we think physics or laws should be mathematical or might be mathematical, what sorts of mathematics might be relevant? So this is by no means exhaustive. So a typical law in the modern framework is written as a PDE, where we could look at general geometry. So this is really the focus of the primary focus of Julian's work, and the PDEs are.
Could I say it's groups rather than geometries? I think because the geometries are the representations of the groups, as I would understand mathematics, correct?
Okay.
You could correct me.
Groups.
I mean, G and God begin with the same letter. Some mathematicians like to sort of think of it that way.
G and God. Okay.
only in English, though.
Topology, too, okay? If you wanted a kind of a stripped-down physics that thought too much structure and geometry, you might move to topology, and there could be different kinds of differential topology, point set topology.
And all of those books on those topics are all written in predicate logic.
Predicate logic,
and
right.
And overhead category theory.
Oh, yes, we didn't invite those people, but. Hi, Chris. Category theory, and then, yeah, predicate logic. Now, I think when you get down to predicate logic, you're starting to. My own feeling, which I'll just. My worry is that if we include that as part of mathematics, everything starts looking mathematical. Anything that can be expressed.
I think you have to put category theory below predicate logic if you listen to some of the category theory.
Well, this wasn't supposed to be in any, this is a hierarchy or anything.
But I would say that actually then touches on the question of number 11 originally. And this is where Godel could come in and all those kinds of things, is that, you know, might there be some other language other than predicate logic or something that we just are too dim-witted to come up with? At some
Right. Okay. So this is a non-trivial.
Yeah, that is our
choice.
That is a very non-trivial choice.
Good.
Now, PDEs can be quite misleading about what you mean by that.
Uh-huh.
Because most robust physics can't live with classical PDEs. You're usually using some sort of fair number of functional analysis tools to extend your notion of solution in some way, shape, or form. So we can
you mean not exclusively PDEs, right?
Unfortunately, all these questions about tolerations of singularity and also delicate questions about boundary conditions, this is where you need to be precise about, you know, so it's a very loose family, I'll just put it that way, as the way you're.
Okay.
And too many philosophers, will take properties actually usually of ODEs, but are often well-behaved PDEs, and assume that the equations of physics have those same nice properties, and that's not true.
Right. Okay. I'm trying to figure out how to. I mean, one way to address this. Actually, I would like to talk about this first, and then one thing to way to discuss this segment of the board is. To fill it in a little bit more detail in the way that Mark is suggesting, and also just to suggest, are there other alternatives, other forms of mathematics that have been left out entirely? But Yeah, Kevin?
So I would add probability theory and order theory too.
All right. Oh, I know, I had another one too.
And of course, Greg Chaitin would say computation theory, Turing machines in there, Chomsky hierarchy.
Game theory. What would Chaitin say?
Chomsky hierarchy. That's what he's all about. Turing machines, what they can and can't do.
Right.
So obviously relation number six. That's John Wheeler again in the original sense rather than Julian's flip of it, of it from bit kind of things.
Uh-huh. Mm.
He's in it from bit.
All right, so these are all forms of mathematics, but do we, why could we, could perhaps say, so in local physics, typically uses portions of these. The physics.
But what, do you want to add stuff on the other side as well?
So well, like, sure, yeah. Yeah. So that, what I wanted to ask was, well, maybe the physics that's relevant for cosmology, some of it falls into this category, not particularly mathematical at all. So it is helpful to sort of.
So I'm just thinking, like, just to sort of to set the sort of science in perspective, there are kind of radical things that ones that are not mathematics that people, that humans do, which, for example, you know, psychic powers, people can have those, or you know, visions, and or authority-based, particularly like you believe in the Bible or something like this. There's a whole bunch of things that people do, which don't come under any of those, which aren't really scientific, but at least are human
ways activities. Of organizing the world. Maybe.
Ways of organizing the world. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So what should I
transform the world too?
Indeed. Yeah.
So
for a nice. I don't know, what do you want to call it?
The I Ching.
Humanities?
No.
Do
a parapsychology, the philosophy.
So way out stuff.
Way out stuff. That just seems to prejudice the.
Let's be honest, popular culture.
No,
that's
not a way of organizing.
How about esoteric?
Superstition, whatever that might actually mean.
I can tell this is a physics group because we've got the superstition realization is now on the board.
Extra scientific.
Yeah. Thank you, Jeanette. That's helpful.
The power of human correspondence.
All right.
Please, what's that?
Like things like narrative and historical explanation.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Just the stuff that still would count as.
Well, it's a huge grab bag, right? Yeah.
But to make it non-preferential.
Yeah, you know, it sounds better.
But actually, that's such a thing. When we talk about extra scientific, so we're talking about the scientific method, that brings up a whole other set of things that were original themes, which is the role, is it essential or is it not, of statistical inference. How the scientific method relates to our discovery of laws of nature. And because of its actual limitations itself, does that somehow...
Okay, I'm not going to put that on the board, but that would be an argument, I suppose, for ruling out extra scientific explanation.
If you can justify the scientific method.
Yeah, so do you want to speak on that more then?
The scientific method, there was some work, for example, in computer science, where people try to automate the scientific method for systems that discovered Kepler's laws from just observations and things like this, just try to build up from instances, overall laws, usually done with like genetic programming and things like this. They are not all that successful. And nobody's actually been able to make an automated scientist, though it's actually been a goal of many machine learners. And it touches on the more general, really appealing goal of get rid of all scientists. We can just replace them all with computer programs that are doing what we do, right, or at least automatically. But that all, of course, begs the question of what is the correct way to go from all of our experimental data we have now to the unknown. We are pushing outward on Marcello and company's perimeter,
mm-hmm.
and we are doing it with this thing called the scientific method, which I'm just noting contrasts with the extra scientific explanation. And mm-hmm. is there something that can be said about the correctness or incorrectness of the many, many different approaches, which have been the subject of many wars in statistics, for how to actually
infer the many things that are called the scientific method?
How to do induction. And that's what science really is an exercise in induction. You're making predictions.
Right. Okay. So somebody might argue that we should leave this on the board until we can justify induction.
Well, exactly. What I'm saying is the flip side of that,
right.
Number four, is can we actually, in some sense, from first principles, justify the scientific
question? As a method of, say, addressing the history of the...
So what's first principles?
There's all kinds of...
These are the kinds of things that Kevin was alluding to.
First principles, proofs of Occam's razor, and of many other kinds of techniques that are actually used in statistics. And there have been many different schools that have attempted to do that. I mean, Bayesian statistics, James, has not been discussed much here, though certainly Kevin and so on, where you use group theoretic arguments to set up things like priors for your doing things, statistical inference. And there's lots that could be, and is, and has been for a long time, debated about those kinds of things.
Rob, you had?
I don't want to sidetrack this discussion.
Oh, it was separate? Okay.
It was a separate point.
All right, does somebody want to follow on with that? Yeah.
Well, I just wanted to throw in, I didn't identify the scientific method with induction. I think vastly more important is insight into connections of things.
How is insight any different from induction?
Suddenly, I mean, I think Roger Penrose says this, suddenly you see something, the mathematician sees some relationship between things, which is sort of not out of the inductive method, I think. That's my feeling.
That's part of the possible question. To what degree is the entire exercise something that's a normative component we can derive how it should be addressed or not?
Right. Somebody might call that extra scientific, but you want to include it in the scientific.
It's a long time since I read Roger's The Emperor's New Mind, but he has this thing about, like, you know, when does the mathematician see the great truth, and what is that process that's going on?
Yeah.
Okay. And I think this is a really relevant thing.
Mm-hmm. Shagan?
Yeah, I wonder whether one criterion should be something should be, a statement should be falsifiable by experiments or in principle by the experiments. A statement which cannot be falsified by experiments, then I don't know what to think about that.
Right. I don't want to drift too far from the topic of this session, though, because I think we're getting this bit about confirmation falsification. This is up here not to so much to clarify the scientific method, but to give an example. This list was to give an example of things that we are prima facie scientific that are not mathematical, and to sort of open.
Yeah, causation should be on the list.
Causation. Okay.
There's evidence that neonates can do causal.
Causal inference, but causation is not I don't know. I would have said it's not a form of a theory. So if we're looking for, we're worried about
it. Is. I mean, some ordinary people state their knowledge in terms of causes, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's how they start doing it. That's what Aristotelian physics looks like. That's because it's what people do naturally.
Okay, you're right. It's a non-mathematical mode of explanation.
Right, yeah.
Okay, which might be common to all of these.
Yes.
Okay.
Here's another example of that kind. Philosophers talk about psychology a lot, and the idea being that we all have a sort of intuitive understanding of how people work in terms of beliefs, rational preference.
Okay.
Which actually touches on another issue, which is to what degree can we escape our own restrictions and how we formulate our laws of nature? You know, we're just descendants of string of hypotheses and so on, which is where presumably the evolutionary psychology, all of our folk psychology, comes from. The usual thing about why should entities designed to hunt game on the savannah be able to do things like QCD? And might there be other things that we can't do because of what we're designed for, quote unquote?
Okay. Kevin. Yeah.
Analogy and metaphor.
All right.
You know, Steve, this is getting like the perfect time to quote William James, as I have to do. and I think this is relevant for this exact reason.
Go ahead.
So this is something that I sent my students recently. The guys here from PI know that I've got my students working very hard on trying to prove the existence of a certain mathematical structure. And so far, we haven't had great success, but there's a lot of evidence that this thing exists. And I tell the students all the time that even if the damn things don't exist, we're going to make them exist. And so I recently sent them this quote from James, and it seems appropriate. He's talking about something he calls the faith ladder.
faith uses a logic altogether different from reason's logic. Reason claims certainty and finality for her conclusions. Faith is satisfied if hers seem probable and practically wise. Faith's form of argument is something like this. Considering a view of the world, it is fit to be true, she feels. It would be well if it were true. It might be true. It may be true. It ought to be true, she says. It must be true, she continues. It shall be true, she concludes. For me, that is. I will treat it as if it were true so far as my advocacy and actions are concerned. So I think this is William James's faith ladder, something that lies outside of the issue of induction. It was closer to something like Julian was talking about. A mathematician very often, or a physicist very often, sort of divines what should be true and then throws all of his energy into trying to make it true if the world will let that happen. So I'd say put the faith ladder.
Right. No. Okay. I think we're sort of like really have two topics here. One is what form might the law take? This is a kind of an art. Settle down in the back. You've been passing notes back there, but it's
I wanted to make a proposal that's a long way away from faith.
Okay. So I just finished. But my thought was I think the issue, the epistemic issues, are one thing about how you. There's epistemic issues, how you justify and arguably discover the laws. This was originally a question which I want to at least address in part about what form laws of physics might take. So initially this was, I offer these as an example. Okay, I want to stay focused on physics, not just talk about what sorts of ways we might order the world. I think it's getting a little bit...
Well, it does really things like multiverse, as was part.
Okay, good, morning. Good. So who was next? I'm sorry. Yeah, Mark had something, and then...
In the history of physics, there are questions about the scope of mathematics and whether how ably mathematical process can track physical process through long periods of time. And so there have been many views that you can run a modeling for a certain sort of period of time. At some point it's going to get off track, and then you actually have to look to nature and start over with a new modeling to carry through. So there's no one, it's a question of whether there's one modeling that can carry through, match the processes of nature accurately over long periods of time. And sort of a modern paradigm, so people like Descartes had that attitude that mathematics had to look for opportunities in nature where its devices could actually
get a purchase, right. Mm-hmm.
And I take it that was kind of the spirit. And a nice model is the conventional treatment of fractions. So you have some sort of piece of iron or something under strain. Okay, now your basic mathematics is a bunch of PDEs. Okay, under certain initial and boundary conditions, stress will build up in the solid long before you get any blow up, which you might get. It'll become impossibly high, and any real material would have to do something different. But your equations are incapable of telling you when that would happen. So what the modelers do is they use the PDEs, but then they perform a check. And this happens a lot of times in continuum modeling. You run kind of a background check on your modeling. If you find stresses that have built up too high, you say, okay, this thing's going to break. And maybe you don't. No, it won't give you a deterministic answer of where it's going to break or how it's going to break. You have to look to nature to find the break, and then you start over with your broken thing. The PDEs can't change topology, and a fracture is going to change the topology. So you actually don't have one continuous all the way through modeling. You have an opportunity, you could handle it pretty well for this period of time, but you just have to look to new physics to start over again. And so there's a is historic, and you'll find in many authors that that's the best we can do with mathematical physics, is a sort of episodic coverage of nature.
Right, okay, I see what you mean. And arguably this sort of takes aside in the whole the unification debate and the...
It's just an ambiguity in your question. How well can we deal with nature mathematically? This is on the borderline. We can deal with almost everything mathematically, but we're not dealing with it at all in a unified mathematics. So there are these jumps. And of course, the analogy with the alleged collapse of the wave function is palpable here. You might want to approach it in this vein.
Okay, comments on that?
In that very example of fracture, indeed the PDEs that you are using does break down, but doesn't tell you that there aren't deeper PDE, partial differential equations that you cannot use to describe the fracture process.
I was just talking about how the conventional mathematics is. Now, actually, probably, look, there's all sorts of things going on in modern theories of fracture, but one, the most natural temptation is move to molecular modeling. And at that point, but then you're giving up on the PDE.
No, you're not, are you? I mean, because molecular physics is based on Schrodinger's equation.
Well, you're giving up on the PDEs.
Giving up on the PDEs with which you start. That's all I mean.
So let me just say, I mean, this seems to be, there's a couple of different reactions. One is sort of Niesch's reaction, the reaction of a lot of physicists was, there must be a consistent mathematical description underneath this. This just wasn't the one. But you might imagine somebody saying that all physical laws take mathematical form, but they exist in this patchwork kind of, they have to be applied in a kind of patchwork fashion, as you're suggesting. Or,
I wasn't advocating.
I'll advocate that. But, okay, so first we take that on, we'll personify this view. And then somebody else might say, well, fundamental physics, or certain aspects of fundamental physics, are non-mathematical. So you might have a theory of the Big Bang singularity that is, I'm throwing this out there, I'm not suggesting it or advocating it, that doesn't have, that is not mathematical in nature, that somehow there's some non-mathematical principle that dictates the so-called initial conditions for the universe.
The ancient conundrum of is math a description of reality, or is reality just an instantiation of math?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's part of it.
I think the notion of not being covered is a little problematic here. In some sense, all events are covered by a mathematical physics, but it's a lack of unity in that coverage. It's not exactly the extraneous elements or extraneous modes of description or plain sound.
Yeah.
That's all.
Kevin, you want to take between the sure, and I don't want to.
I guess I see it this way. If you consider a bigger problem, the universe, the best model I could possibly think of for the universe is the universe itself. But that's not what we're doing. We have a relevant issue that we're interested in. In his case, it's how iron behaves under strain. Not how it fractures, but how it behaves under strain. So you ignore the irrelevant details, and in this case it would be fractured iron, and now you develop a model of that, and that's your theory. And now if you start looking at, you start looking at it, put this under more strain, more strain, more strain, all of a sudden you realize, well, this doesn't quite work. And the reason is because, well, everything's interconnected. That's all interconnected. You've ignored the relevant details, and they're irrelevant according to this question, but in some sense they're not totally irrelevant, because at some point, they become relevant again. And now you find out that description of that simplified picture isn't sufficient. So now you end up having to create this patchwork. And I think this patchwork comes from the fact that you are asking a relevant question, and you're only looking at relevant details, and you're ignoring the irrelevant ones. But at some point, those details become, once you start pushing it, those details become relevant.
Actually, the interest, though, of course, of the engineer in calculating strain is to know when the building's going to fracture.
Right. So now you want to create all of that, really, is what they're.
Well, you don't have to have that. If the strain becomes too great, don't build your building that way.
Just more on that? I mean, I think of many over here.
Yeah, I don't know whether this comes in this argument or not. It's about the limitation of mathematics. And But one comment I want to make is that a lot of physical theory use real numbers. Almost all physical theory use real numbers. And so because of that, those physical theory are somehow constrained. And the reason is that I think from quantum mechanics and general relativity is well known that a 2-point is separated by whose separation is smaller than Planck scale doesn't make any sense in this world, at least. So that's really an argument that the real numbers simply don't exist. It's just a human imagination, but it's not really there. And so
you don't use them now, is that right?
I use them,
right.
But however, it's like I use hydrodynamics,
yeah.
And knowingly it's wrong. So I'm knowingly using the wrong theory because I don't have molecular dynamics. And so I don't know what this. So if one using this argument, one basically says that any theory contains real numbers, and a complex number cannot be a correct theory. So that's really led to the this list of the first three probably is not there. Maybe starting from fifth, it may become more real. I don't know. It's really a term as a guidance for in which direction a physical theory might develop. And so whether using real number in our physical theory, we all just constrain ourselves to something.
There's a whole set of interesting.
And then by developing theory without using real number, whether that may solve some theoretical problem like singularity problem, etc. And also, more importantly, if a theory with real number are wrong and a theory, and then what kind of prediction one can make if you do some precision experimental measurement? Then there are some error one should discover. I mean, for example, there are some rule, some identity should be always hold if you use real number, but actually they are not there, one can test it. So basically that's really pointing the direction that how theory might develop in the next stage, whether an attempt to abandon real number can be a motivation rather than try to get simpler theory. You know, it's usually theory derived as a motivation, like simplicity, more symmetry. But maybe maybe another motivation, and that's me try to.
Right.
What is the limitation? Yeah, that's
Ariel. It's a short comment on the necessity of mathematics.
Not on the real numbers in particular, though.
It's essentially that the nature of an answer depends first and foremost on what the question was, and as long as we ask quantitative questions, we have to use mathematics because that's what quantitative means. So if we start asking qualitative questions only, then you don't need mathematics for that. But the moment we become quantitative, there is no way to avoid it.
Right. John, you had something.
I suggest number 8 for the list, and this is another instance of when you hear it, you might not want to write it down. Another instance of throwing something out without advocating. So John Leslie has this idea that the universe we find ourselves in exists because it's ethically required. It's not that there's a benevolent designer who made it. It's that its ethically requiredness by itself explains why it's here. But if that were true, or if that is true, is that a physical law? Is it a law of nature? Is it part of physics, or is it something else? Would that be a non-mathematical?
Right. Well, yeah. This is a, like kind of a Leibnizian sort of.
If your question is why do we have these initial conditions rather than some other, if that were true, it might be an answer. It might be a non-mathematical answer to a question that is about why the.
Okay. Yeah.
What kind of question is that? If this thing you just said. That's true.
Yeah, right. So David and then Hugh.
I'd like to actually respond to what someone talked about, real numbers, and actually what Julian was talking about earlier this morning, having to do with angles earlier. So, yeah. And all these actually have very, very strong epistemological components to it. Forget some quote-unquote underlying theory that's out there. What we have direct access to, what we have only have access to, is in our own noggins. And that, arguably, is actually a bunch of finite. This is the kind of thing I'm going to say, arguably. But if the only thing that any particular scientist, philosopher, any particular human being can have in their head is going to be some...
It's the Bekenstein bound for psychology.
if it's going to be some finite amount of information,
yeah.
Then that suggests that any kind of real numbers or uncountable things back there would just be constructs or helping us find patterns relating finite things.
Yeah, this surplus structure, right, yeah. Hugh?
Oh, this is just a small, slightly tongue-in-cheek comment on John's suggestion. The name of it, when if you were taking this Leibniz lesbian proposal seriously, then you'd soon be back in the mathematics again because you'd be wanting to impose an order structure on the space of possible worlds.
Yeah,
you know, to find out which one was the best one.
Mm-hmm. Right. I was fishing around in my own mind for, I'll throw this out and then I'll open it back up to Kevin, for an example of this, and it just occurred to me that, you know, Lee Smolin's cosmological natural selection is an attempt to do part of cosmology with a principle of analogous to natural selection. So it has a mathematical component, but it has a non-mathematical component. So... arguably an example of a way to use a non-mathematical principle in... But it's either mathematical or it's also been called tautological. So there's a whole interesting debate as to what... Okay, right. Well, I'm throwing that out there. Obviously, there's not an open and shut moral, but I mean, it's a way of tying it into this list of things that aren't, you know, on the surface, they certainly don't look like, there's no PDEs, there's not a lot of...
In natural selection, there are no PDEs.
All right, I'm not going to... Yeah. There are, actually. David will tell us in a moment what they are. I'll shut up because... Kevin. I'll let Kevin talk.
Okay. I'm not going to talk about evolution.
I'd
just like to make a helpful suggestion maybe for the right-hand side.
Okay.
One of the things I've taken a look at, and it's pretty interesting in terms of thinking about mathematics and theories and computability, you know, that mixture of issues, is definability theory and descriptive set theory. So there you have you look at definability in arithmetic or topologically of collections of discrete sequences you can think of as solutions, and then there are results that relate to the sense in which you could decide the set of sequences to the computational complexity of the sequences themselves. And a collection of results called basis theorems give you huge divergence between the computability of the solutions and the sense in which you can test the laws that have those solutions. And there are some nice extreme cases where you can give an implicit definition of a unique solution.
Mm-hmm.
And then that solution turns out to be infinitely uncomputable, but a Turing machine can actually refute the theory itself with certainty, right, in a computational way, which almost sounds paradoxical. So I think this is a nice sort of exercise in thinking about what science would have to be like in order for computational science to cope with it.
I see. Okay.
Right. So I mean, it could turn out that the predictive it's possible in set theory that
so this is kind of a meta framework for studying these various.
Yeah, I mean, you could think of this as like a really abstract way to look at discrete solutions to a thing that's like a differential equation, right? So I'm talking metaphorically here, but I mean, it could be you're looking at a discrete process. You know, I mean, it could be that a box landed on the beach and it started producing natural numbers and. You might think, oh, is this thing an oracle for the truths of arithmetic,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, did the Martians really give us something that's going to crack all possible computational problems we can conceive of? Well, that's an interesting empirical question to test, isn't it? How would you even start? But it turns out that there are questions that hard
mm-hmm.
that a Turing machine can refute with certainty, even though no possible machine, even with an infinitely powerful oracle, could compute the function that's coming out of the box. So I think, you know, that's a kind of an interesting place to look for metaphors about the potential power of
computable
science.
Mm-hmm. Good. Good. Rob?
I can get back to adding something on the left. So this is a bit ill-formed, but I'm hoping maybe people can clarify it. So I think there's a pragmatic mode of explanation. So a lot of this feels, you know, that this is, you know, if we think of science as helping us to predict things and describe things, then the mode of explanation has to be in account. But science is, you know, you really have explained something if you can then use it to, you know, build a better steam engine or, you know, do something interesting. And furthermore, when you explain by analogy and metaphor, you're not necessarily confined to everyday concepts, but you may make analogies to human artifacts, things that required engineering and design principles to actually get. So it seems to me today we explain a lot of things by analogy to computers, and we didn't have computers before. So there's, I don't know exactly what to describe it as, but maybe just a pragmatic mode of explanation. You explain it by building.
How is that different from prediction?
I
predict that if I configure things this way, they will behave such and such.
So David Deutsch has this nice bit in his book where he says, if I give you an oracle that would answer every question, it would be perfect for prediction. You wouldn't need a scientific theory. So you ask the oracle, if I build my refrigerator or my spaceship this way, will it fly? And the oracle says no. So the oracle doesn't help you as much as the scientific theory would help you come up with the idea of how to build a spaceship that might actually fly.
Is that the scientific theory, or your ability to invert it, to do engineering?
Well, Deutsch argues, and I think he's right, that that's the scientific theory.
I think a good example of this is something in Ulam's book, Adventures of a Mathematician, where he says, it never ceases to amaze me the power of a few scribbles on a blackboard to change the world. So the sort of thing that I think Rob is talking about is you can put a few scribbles on a blackboard and they become a kind of focus of attention so that you say to yourself, I have some human need or I have something that I want to build. And you focus on this little thing called a theory, and it helps extract from you all the ideas that are needed for putting together a piece of equipment. Or maybe you're not thinking that, but you promoted me to think about this.
So we had this kind of an order.
So I wouldn't call this prediction at all. It's just here is a set of concepts in front of us that we can make use of, like we can make use of a hammer and a screwdriver. And it's up to us to find all the ways of jiggling this thing until we get what we want.
Is that engineering or science? If we were to have your oracle, would that be the end of science? Not at all the end of engineering. But would that then be a theory of everything, not a theory of how to engineer everything?
It's a theory of nothing.
Your point is something more like Maxwell's Eigler wheels for the displacement current. I mean, that strikes me as really revealing. You know,
what it is?
Nothing there. He had a mechanical explanation of displacement current in terms of idler wheels and vortices.
Idler wheels, D-L-E-R. Yeah, they just said.
I'm not saying one mode of explanation is mechanical. I admit, you know, there's mechanical, energetic information types of explanations. But what I was more trying to emphasize is that there's not just sort of the act of explaining things. There's also the act of going out there in the world, messing around and building something new. And we usually think of that as engineering and unrelated to, you know, the process of scientific explanation. But actually, in the long run, I think it is an important part of the overall attempt at explaining things. You know, now that I can point to a computer and say, oh, you know what it's like living in a virtual world, right? Well, let me try to explain, you know, how the world really works in terms of that analogy. Couldn't have done that unless somebody had built that computer for me already.
Yeah, I guess I was just picking up on that idea because, I mean, Maxwell's thing, I think, really makes it, you know, the equations by themselves are a little funny. I think he really found that to be a helpful device in coming up with the theory. Like, here's how it would work. For one thing, it's like, if there's an assemblage of ways that some equation could work out, it's sort of like they're contributing to the prior probability of the equations.
Yeah.
So I think there's an interesting debate in philosophy of science that all of you are actually scientists. It would be interesting hear about, which is, I think, you know, a lot of philosophers agree with you that theoretical knowledge isn't just like a list of answers to questions, right? But there's a hell of a lot more. And Kevin suggested that one thing that people often associate with theoretical knowledge is a kind of knowledge based on modeling experience or mental models. And that might be a really important heuristic part of discovering new ideas and so on. But I guess one question is that always mathematical to tie it back into this debate? And also, how important is that aspect of knowledge compared to what you might think of as more just like the list of answers to questions?
Right, or does it count as law-like if it can't be mathematized? Right, yeah. It just relates to insight and intuition. If you have a model that enables you to do things, but doesn't lead to any numbers, does it count as a law or some general principle of nature?
Laws of nature, should that be expanded then to include laws of design within nature?
Design is a good word, yeah.
That would be expanding this to not be just laws of nature, but including laws or whatever you want to call them, of design.
Okay, let me, Julian had and then Janine.
One of the most magical experiences for me was reading Schrödinger's space-time structure, where he draws attention to the incredible importance of the number zero. And it's when you've got an equation that one thing is exactly zero. And that's invariant. You can't multiply naught by anything you like and it remains naught. And we perhaps haven't emphasized the importance of naught, zero. That's a crucial thing when you see. I mean, the Einstein field equation that the Ricci curvature scale is exactly zero. What's the status of that in these discussions, I wonder? It's a very wonderful
unless there's a cosmological constant, right? In which case, the curvature minus the cosmological,
yes,
right? Yeah.
I think it's food for thought as to
what. Well, it reminds me of Wheeler's, principle that the boundary of a boundary is zero, which is kind of triviality, or it's a deep comment on the forms of nature, depending on how you take it. It's and who is. Is there something for Hugh? Go ahead.
One thing that occurs to me that ought to be on the list, on the left hand side, indeed in some ways it deserves to be at the top of the list, is connected to some of the things.
Zero, I will use.
Well, yeah. But between zero and one, I think folk physics ought to go in there. And there's been one way of getting at this.
No, it's like folk psychology, but folk physics.
It's more important in this debate, right, because one of the very interesting questions, which is related to some of the issues that have been coming up, for example, about the role of time, is to what extent actual physics is or should be kind of constrained by the sort of folk intuitions we have about what kinds of things the world is made of and how they interact. And there's been a lot of interesting work recently on looking at the kind of physics that infants have. And this is something I think Kevin mentioned, the work infants in causation, and it's sort of one aspect of that, infants expect objects to continue to exist and can be surprised when they're presented with evidence that they don't.
Whether these are kind of non-mathematical constructs.
Well, they clearly are non-mathematical, and
right.
What's more. And another good example is what's effectively locality. I mean, it seems to be the case that infants expect causation by contact.
Is this not the Aristotelian physics?
Well,
it's pretty close to it. It's the first step to it.
Well, that's why I said it should be further
up. Oh, I beg your pardon. Yeah.
We use the negative numbers, which don't exist, we could use. Janan, you had something? No? Okay, because I thought that actually tied in with some. Well, with your thoughts on ontology, really. Who is and was Zhao Gang, I guess. Oh, Lucian. Yeah.
So I thought it'd be interesting just to think of what constitutes a physical law, because that provides some insight into how mathematics is or might be used. And it seems to me that to do physics, you need two things. You need a description of the world, whether it's an operational description or ontological description. You need something that constitutes a description of the world. Then you need some other part of the world, something that mathematics can play the role of, which is a way of manipulating symbols and whatever. And a physical law sits in the middle. It has two legs. It has one leg in a description of the world, and it has another leg in, for example, mathematics. And so physical law has to have that character, has to point both at the description of the world and also at something such as mathematics. It could also be something on the surface, it doesn't have to be mathematics. It has to be something that you use to organize knowledge. And so that seems...
What is it that you're organizing? I'm just trying to
Well, I mean, when you make predictions, you typically when you do physics, you go through some manipulations. But those manipulations are just, you know, in case of physics, are just mathematics, so do a calculation. But what's important is that calculation points and tells you something about the description of the world. So by itself, a piece of mathematics isn't physics. It's only because the mathematics contains links to a description of the world that it constitutes physics. And so physical laws have to be things that sit in the middle, that have one leg in each of those two camps in order.
So you're thinking that description always has to be in these sort of folk physical terms that we sort of demand? No, this is actually something that Bohr...
I don't think necessarily that. I think you can have a description of the physical world that might look quite mathematical. You may associate letters or symbols with different aspects of the world. But that's a different activity to the activity you engage in when you're doing a calculation to make a prediction, for example. So one place where it might be relevant is this debate that idea that Max Tegmark has had, that every possible mathematical theory or whatever or structure corresponds to the real world. Well, that's just a mathematical structure. To make it correspond to the real world, you need to point to a description of the world. So that's lacking, and that's why I say you need both of these aspects. In order to get some traction, so I'm saying that physical law is something that sits in the middle.
That gets very, very. That touches on the issue of is mathematics description of the world.
So I'm trying to separate out. I'm trying to say mathematics is exists by itself. That's why you have pure mathematics.
So this would be mathematics describing the world, as opposed to Max is saying that the world is mathematics, and because the power of that statement is almost an often derisive one. If the world is just mathematics, that means we ourselves are just mathematics. How can you actually refute this? And if you can't, then you don't need anything extraneous like a separate world.
Kind of like the way you refute the statement, I am a shoe. It's absurd.
Seriously. I go along with Max, and I think we are the mathematical forms who miraculously are aware of ourselves, but we are aware of the structure we have, and that's a non-trivial thing.
You have to, does that, just like that far side sketch, you have to account for the miracle there.
This is a miracle, whatever everyone thinks about it.
Well, this is interesting. I mean, it's very easy. The direction of my book. Chris is going to go turn into a shoe, an expensive one.
But I'm not saying mathematics is a description of the laws of mathematics. But to turn mathematics into physics, you need things that live in the middle.
I'm saying that one can, back as Max would, and to a degree that I think as Julian would, and frankly, to pin the wall, I would say you can't find any testable aspect of anything that's got to do with your consciousness that would refute the notion that you are. That the chess pieces playing chess, the laws of chess are just as real to them as Newton's laws are to you.
Maybe. So I suppose my claim would be we could go for every example of some physical theory we have, and I could extract this element I'm talking about, but it may take a while. So physical theories are at least what I'm saying they are. Now you could have a different understanding, but a piece of mathematics by itself constitutes a physical theory. I just don't see that.
Well, I see that as one of the big lessons of quantum mechanics.
Oh, let's let some other people get in on this. Sylvia?
Yeah, so one remark that springs to mind is that you can refute the idea that is it scientific or not. Because you can't classify it. So that would be the first thing. But the thing is that if you believe that all of mathematics is real, that doesn't really explain why we see these specific mathematical structures, and I think that's roughly the point that Lucien was trying to make. You still need some sort of map from all of mathematics to what we see here to identify it.
Well Max would say
you need to know your place.
Max would say it's a mathematical multiverse. That all of them are
equal. He has said that, that's
where
true.
Are you in the multiverse?
Anthropic.
By definition, it's just like a chess piece is playing chess.
Well, since everything exists,
just as an example, you're in that one.
No, but this is the problem. Then your question is whether that's falsifiable.
Yeah,
it's not whether he has some. So that's what Max would say.
A lot of public, it's simple.
But, oh, Yeah. Okay. So there's a worry about that procedure that Max is, well, it's not really a procedure, that sort of set of ideas that I think Sabine is. And then, Kevin, you want to touch on this also?
Yeah, I would follow up on that.
Good.
And point out that not all of the mathematics, the field's areas of mathematics, is just on the weather fundamental. I mean, for instance, you drive probability from order theory. And you can actually drive topology from order theory. PDEs are based on summation, which is drivable from order theory. So I think there's a fundamental level of mathematics that has to do with relationships between things associated with distributivity and commutivity.
Mm-hmm.
These are the fundamental ideas that I think are critical. PDEs, not fundamental at all.
But Kevin, do you know that order theory can't be derived from probability theory?
Do you know that?
Or is it just your preferred direction
of
going to...
Probability theory is a specific case of order theory. Order theory is
probability. But maybe order theory can be viewed as a specific case of probability theory if you shuffle it around.
I don't see how you would get...
Probability theory is a physical theory. ...structures that
don't show up in probability theory.
Probability theory is a physical
theory. You want me to react?
You have to be careful about what you're arguing. Look, using, you know, classical molecular models, you can set up what Gibbs called analogies to thermodynamics. That does not mean in the real world that the truth of thermodynamics derives from those sorts of models. So that derivation is irrelevant to their truth, and, or validity or applicability of the world. And that's probably quite easily the case with PDEs. They can be true on their own grounds, you know, if you've got a real life continuum or something more complicated, and it does not have to be built on finite structures. Maybe you can imitate them with finite structures, but that's not any proof that that's what their real basis is. You have to be careful. It might be true and it's worth exploring those programs, but you shouldn't be so dismissive. I mean,
well, I thought that Kevin was basically offering something resembling a critique of Max's idea that if you really wanted to consider this space of all structures, you'd have a rather redundant specification because some of them are part of others. So I think you guys are both kind of going in the same direction, but offering a different kind of critique of the same idea that there's this well-defined space of fundamental mathematical structures over which there's some distribution, and we're at some point in that space.
And I was only offering a very simple point, that one man's garbage is another man's treasure,
yeah.
And one man's axiom is another man's theorem, and another man's theorem is another man's axiom. And I mean, this certainly plays out in all different sorts of axiomatizations of any one of these branches. So it's not obvious to me that.
Anthony, is Max's colleague, would you like to defend
that? That order theory is the tetragram.
I just had a quick question. What about getting group theory out of order theory? Is that okay?
No, because like I showed in the slide, they're one group theory has to do with equivalence relations and partition sets. In order group order theory is. Looks at order relations on ordered sets. So
yeah, it should be.
Analogous, but not.
Okay. Kevin, and then John, and.
Yeah, I just have a little comment. A bit back, there was a sort of duality between mathematics and just numerical. And just in light of what's been said, mathematics, I think, is a lot more general than what's numerical. And there have been some developments. In our department where, as a matter of fact, people have worked out proof systems based on geometrical figures, right? So, I mean, the fact that scribblings are what mathematics has to look like is not necessarily definitive of mathematics either. I actually think that if...
So it's Penrose's diagrammatic calculus.
Yeah, I mean, what is it like? Yeah, or you can actually, you know, you can... If you're careful about topology of overlapping lines, then it turns out Euclidean diagrams can actually be a sound and complete proof system over some fragment. And so, I mean, Euclid knew what he was doing with the diagram, not just with the lines of text. And so it seems to me that when a diagram is, you know, what's really crucial is that you reform language so you can stop equivocating, and then you can really rely on chains of reasoning. It doesn't really matter what you're talking about as long as you're not equivocating and
so this builds in a continuity with logic, really. This is,
yeah,
this is
which is not
obviously quantitative.
I even think if your diagrams are really carefully chosen so that you don't have accidental coincidences in them, right? And you thought about it hard. The diagram itself is just mathematics. Sometimes I trust those more than proofs.
John, you had
I wanted to ask Lucien to say more about the really interesting metaphor of the walls having a leg in the math and a leg in the description of the universe. Because I wonder if you could say more to spell out how that metaphor works. Because I mean, it seems clear that if the universe isn't just mathematics, then there's got to be something that sits between them, something that sort of mediates between pure mathematics and the description of the world, so that one can fit onto the other.
Right.
But why do you think that physical laws are the things that do that job? And how would could you talk about an example of a physical law doing that job and how?
I mean, I have a paper coming out next week, but I mean, that would be an hour talk, and I want to do that. But I think, at least in the case of that paper, the crucial thing that connects the mathematics with the description is a succinct statement that could be regarded as a physical law. And it contains, so it's a kind of hybrid statement. It contains elements that point to a physical description and elements that point to mathematical objects. But that law itself has both of those. You know. And so you have one piece of paper on which you can sort of have the symbols you use to describe the physical world. Another sheet of paper on which you have the symbols you use to do your mathematics. The physical law contains symbols that come from both of those pieces of paper. So I could give an example, but I need much more time.
Okay.
To do it in detail.
So the paper's coming out next week.
Well, if I get it finished, yeah.
Oh, okay.
It's awesome.
May I tell a John Wheeler story in connection to John's point and Lucien's point?
Okay.
John Wheeler stories are always
good. Yeah, they're good. They're good. And then Chris.
This one came from John Fresco, who said that he took an undergraduate course with Wheeler in Princeton in the 70s. And at some point in the course, Wheeler got all of the students in the class to write down what they thought of as all of the equations of physics. And then he collected all of the papers from all the students and took them up to the stage in the presentation hall. And he put out all the pages on the ground. And he stood above the pages and he looked out to the students and said, "These papers likely contain all of the equations of physics." And then, in a great commandment, he said down to the papers, "Now fly!" And nothing happened. So he looked out at the students, like, in a confused way, and then he said, "These are all the equations of physics. Now fly!" And nothing happened. And then John turned out to the students and said, "You see, these are all the equations of physics, but they don't fly. The universe flies. And until we get to that one last principle that makes it all fly, they're just equations on a piece of paper." So,
I think Jorge Borges has a bunch of rejoinders, actually, in many of his stories.
There's a nice line in Twelfth Night of Shakespeare. "As the old hermit of Prague very wisely said to King Gorbatov, that is..."
Chris, can you top that?
I was waiting for the follow-up. It's worse and worse. I want to go back to Lucien's way of analyzing this, and I think it's interesting because you have sort of the taking information from the world into theory and then the sort of exit move later, and then you have the structure of the mathematics that gives you the machinery for taking information and transferring doing something with it. And I think one of the interesting aspects of that proposal is, as Kevin was suggesting as well, it's not clear. I mean, you need to have some organized way of thinking through things in order to make some kind of inferential moves there. But it's not clear that it has to be mathematical.
Right, yeah, absolutely. It could be palmistry or something.
Really. Right, it's just sort of, as long as you're able to sort of think clearly enough that you can do something with the, after you've made the initial move into the theoretical structure.
Right, and then I suppose this is related to David's. If you thought that inference was logical inference, and that logical inference was mathematical, then you would say you were demanding mathematics. But if you have a narrower sense of mathematics, right, yeah, or a broader sense of inference, then you wouldn't. But, you know, some sort of inference that didn't involve logic or propositional or predicate logic. So that, am I being unfair to you? I'm just trying to represent the view you expressed about half an hour ago. About the role of mathematics.
Yeah, I think that captured it. Actually, also, I'm very, very curious about Lucene's. Where is it appearing?
Oh, I don't know. Okay.
Okay. Because it actually, how is that procedure that you're describing related to the binding process in predicate logic?
I have no idea. The binding process itself.
Oh, okay. Because it basically sounds like very much this, that the axioms of mathematics have things called variables, mm-hmm. and then you put in different things for those. You need to put in something for those variables to actually get out some kind of a predictive machinery. So it actually sounds very, very closely related to what you're talking about.
Okay.
A couple more on this subject, and then we should maybe move on. Xiaogang, did you have something? Or, and then
yeah, my feeling is that since all the physical theory has to be mathematical in a sense, in my mind, mathematics is just a language to describe a nature phenomenon. But it's called mathematics because this language better not be self-contradicting. So when I have a framework of a description which is guaranteed not self-contradiction, then maybe we call it mathematics. the trouble is that the mathematics all build up from our daily experience. You know, we experience our world and somehow we build up some mathematics follow the experience. But however, there's just like one example, quantum mechanics is a big surprise. And so the world may not be at the fundamental level, may be very different from what our daily experience is. So there's always a possibility that the new kind of mathematics, we have to invent a new kind of mathematics, like new language to describe new phenomena. We cannot use the older language based on the daily experience to describe the new phenomena. That should be very common. Then the different kind of mathematics will be the different framework which is not self-contradicting, but only one of them describe our world. That's what we call a law. So that's the thing. What I mean.
Okay, good. It's a criterion for lawhood then. All right, Janine.
Remark on what Lucene and Christensen pointing out the connection between that way of thinking of the role of mathematics and actual model building, but more basically analogical and metaphorical reasoning. So Max Black, talking about metaphorical reasoning, says it works basically that way. You have some system over here, and it can be a concrete structure, it can be an imaginative picture, it can be a little, you know, sort of machine of some kind, and you have some reason for believing that in relevant respects it mirrors certain parts of reality, so you can think of that as a mapping from elements of thing here to elements of thing there. And for one reason or another, either because the machine or little imaginative picture is easier to manipulate, maybe it's simpler, that mapping is very useful because you can run the machine, right, to predict various things about why would mathematical rather than concrete or imaginative models be especially useful in that role? Well, they're not constrained by, you know, three dimensions and so on. Mm-hmm. So if you think in that way, then that really breaks down the distinction between, you know, mathematical modeling and sort of analogical reasoning. And the kinds of it's absolutely to the point to think the transformations that are being performed needn't be logical. I mean, in fact, that's a highly restricted and very clumsy sort of machine for performing these transformations. And mathematics just gives you a rich space of different structures, you know, choose between them as you like in ways that are pragmatically motivated by the sorts of problems that you want to solve and the sort of limited mapping that you have to reality.
I'd like to throw one thing in there. It just comes to mind. I remember it's just a general worry about, so your idea, which I think is right, is that you have a much bigger space of possible representations of the world when you move to mathematics. And then there's a worry about that we still have to have some sort of cognitive grasp on them. And you can talk about this on many levels. There's the computability level. Can you solve the equations? But just conceptually, I remember distinctly being in a class graduate quantum mechanics class with Bob Wald, and he had to make some point about infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces, and he wasn't sure, and he didn't trust the book, of course, and he wasn't sure what the fact was. And when he started doing, he was doing this. This was his infinite dimensional Hilbert space. Think about that. He does that too. You know, this is how I reason. This was somehow supposed to stand in. Now they're better in what you know. It's a limited heuristic, right? And you think if this is really how you're thinking about these spaces,
but didn't get the right answer.
In this case, yeah. And, you know, this is the thing. I mean, if you really, you can. It's just like we do with drawing, right? So we can draw three-dimensional objects, and we can make correct inferences about them if we. But, you know, you do worry, I worry anyway, that this process has limits, right? That there are really things that you miss. You know, you can write down all kinds of mathematical equations, mathematical objects, but not really grasp all the relevant content because of the limitations of the mind. And I take this as to be a follow from what you said. Anything more?
Still on mathematics.
Good.
So, actually, this might be a segue to that number 8, that's multiple ways of representing the same word. And it seems to me that a lot of these might be what you just mentioned, and an earlier discussion we had about real versus discrete numbers. I think there might be just perfect examples of, there might be equally good, but completely different ways of describing the same events. And in certain situations, different ways might be more comfortable. For example, real versus integer numbers. We know that for any experiment that we make, we have finite resolution or finite precision. So we cannot really distinguish rational numbers from real numbers. So you can have a theory based on rational numbers, which basically based on integers, and a theory based on real numbers, and you never distinguish them. One of these theories might be simpler than the other ones, and we know examples in physics that integer numbers are simpler. Like if you do population studies, that's simpler to talk about the number of people. You have examples where real numbers are simple descriptions, but we may never be able to distinguish these two possibilities. It's just that in some cases the description in terms of real numbers is easier. Some kind of description in terms of continuous numbers. The same true with this infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces, for example, that you might have very complicated description of things, which makes you miss interesting physical phenomena. And you might have equivalent, much simpler descriptions that describe the same physics, but if you think about them in those terms, then you see things that you wouldn't have seen otherwise. So I think at some level, talking about what's fundamental and what's not fundamental might be misleading, because might be that there are different ways of describing things that might be more appropriate in different situations. I mean, the same goes with this question whether time is more fundamental or space is more fundamental. You might have equivalent description of nature that, and for some problems, description based on fundamental time might be more appropriate or more useful or more convenient. And in some cases, description in terms of fundamental space might be more.
Actually, from the first argument or remarks you made, Poincaré said something very much about nature and analysis and physics, and it's too elaborate to go into it. Hadamard just completely took that argument apart. It's worth keeping that. Notion, you can't formulate or make coherent the notion of a well-posed problem, and that's very important.
Is the claim that if you get rid of real numbers, you can't make the...
Well, what Poincaré said, his version was you can't distinguish between them because of the Weierstrass approximation theorem, between a continuous distribution, and you could always replace Perry functions by analytic functions. it's based upon similar.
This is specific to his example, not about the general.
I didn't mean to get into the
general point.
Little,
okay.
But it's a very category that usually regarded as quite right and very deceptive on that problem.
Okay, yes. Yeah. And Janae had something.
This is for touching on the GPS problems that I think has come up a number of times when talking about priority and fundamentality. Think about, the idea that there are transformations in different ways of representing. Think about, just to take a very simple example, the relationship between sort of two-dimensional plane figures. Now, we know we can represent those algebraic, like sort of geometrically on a surface. We know also that we can write down the algebraic representation. We know also, in ways that are easy to describe, that certain problems are going to be very easy to solve with the algebraic representation. There's almost a complementarity there. And it will make other problems hard to solve. And vice versa. Now ask yourself, given that there's a one-to-one mapping, right, ask yourself, well, what are they describing? And which one is more fundamental? What is the triangle, for example? You think of the triangle itself as in some way prior to and independent of these two different ways of representing it. Those are really hard questions, I think, to answer. Which of them is the real triangle?
But I wonder whether we should even ask that question.
You're jolly well better.
Well, let me just throw one thing out. Maybe some people can pick up on this. This is something that was discussed in Feynman's little book, The Character of Physical Law, and he was fascinated by the fact that the laws of classical mechanics could be given in free form. And there was the Newtonian form involving forces. There was the Hamiltonian form. There was the Lagrangian least action formalism. And, I think, his conclusion was that it's good to be able to work with all of them because some of them might generalize better. He thought that the Newtonian picture, the force picture, just goes away in quantum mechanics, but you keep both the Lagrangian and the Hamiltonian picture. And they're equivalent in certain circumstances. It's not true that every theory that has a Lagrangian formulation has a Hamiltonian formulation and vice versa. But in the physics that we're used to, they tend to go together. But his thinking was that just pragmatically, from a methodological point, I take it, they might come apart. Now, he didn't really address, as far as I remember, the ontological significance, which is, I think, more the focus of your remarks.
Right. There's this implicit idea that there's the thing itself that's described by these multiple representations. And I guess in the case at least of the triangle, it's not clear to me, what is the thing itself that these are supposed to be representations of? And what is the structure, the intrinsic structure of the thing itself? I'm not sure that I know how to make sense of that. And I'm not sure how deeply that translates to when you're talking about fundamental structure of the world and why you've got a mathematical.
Well, so in part there's a worry here about whether this debate about whether, the world really has or is correctly represented by the real numbers or only the rationals or only the integers or whatnot is maybe something we don't really have a good grip on. We don't even understand what it would be for one of those statement to be true.
That's a question that keeps arising in my mind when these debates. And it might be just on a biographical remark. I'm not sure.
No, I think it's irrelevant. Perhaps a little bit to live in the same in my tribe. This is something different.
Doreen had something, and then jogging again.
Yeah, just following up on that. It's interesting. We got to this point after starting out. Like Chris was saying about the entry and exit rules. That's more about model building or the instrumental use of a theory, right? So when you say you have multiple ways of representing the same world, you have different representations. How do we know they're the same? Well, because they're empirically equivalent in some sense, right? Or you can use them for the same purposes. But that's, of course, empirical fit is only one of the requirements we have of a theory. Then there are these other questions of representation. When you push them back a level to look at the whatever it is whatever inference rules you're using or however you want to put it, then you're getting pretty far from the world at that point. So. There's these two questions. One is the instrumental goodness of the theory, and then how exactly that relates to questions of goodness of representation or what the right representation is. This is a simple question.
Regarding this representation of reality, I think it's very, very interesting. And I think one example is this fluid dynamics. You know, fluid dynamics at one stage just means a non-Weierstrass equation. You know, that's all we need to know. We can understand everything. So we can, but at that time, we don't care whether what is real fluid dynamics, what's the non-Weierstrass equation, which one is real, that matter too much. But until one day we find a non-Weierstrass equation really not correct, you know, at a certain case, it don't produce right answer. So actually, at that time, we feel non-Weierstrass equation is actually the wrong representation of what we call fluid dynamics, because we can do the experiments. And then we find, oh, there's molecular dynamics. So maybe you should use molecular dynamics to describe fluid. So now, at this stage, it's molecular dynamics maybe is what we think is real fluid. And but until we find molecular dynamics doesn't work, I think that when Schrodinger equation come in, molecular is also not correct. And so at this stage, we think Schrodinger equation is everything, you know. It's hard to say what is beyond Schrodinger equation because we have nothing to contradict with it. And since we can only handle a magnetic object as a series, so we treat the last thing we can handle as a reality. But until we find a contradiction with the experiments, then that's what we have. But on the other hand, since we keep finding the contradictions, it looks like we are always bounded by our previous symbol, invented by totally different reason. You know, it's amazing we still using the same symbol to describe Newton's theory and describe quantum theory. They're totally different thing. But it may not be so surprising until we find that some days quantum theory also wrong. It's very likely quantum theory is wrong, and so then there's the quantum theory is no longer real. So there's another another set of language, another framework of mathematics, and that they call to be real. And things keep going. So yeah, I don't know exactly whether there's ultimate reality or truth. But on the other hand, you know, at each stage seems it's okay, there's a theory or there's a pretended reality.
More comments on this? Totally intractable topic. There's a nice paper I'll just plug here that I like. I assign my students on this question called Realism About What? You guys familiar with this? By Roger Jones. It's cited by Fine in his better known book on the natural ontological attitude, or his paper. Anyway, it discusses a lot of this kind of thing. If you want to be a realist, and you think that your theory corresponds to reality, which reality exactly do you think it corresponds to, and how do you characterize it?
Is that a play on Ian Hacking's book? This social construction of what?
No. If anything, it would be the other way around. That's it. Really, about what is about 30 years old.
Okay.
Anyway.
Let me just remark that those are not received opinions in philosophy. But that's
what aren't?
Either Roger or Arthur. I'm definitely in a different camp,
but
I don't
want to say. Okay. Right. Arthur's it's a separate thing. I thought that the Jones papers, anyway, it's at least a sort of a provocative and fairly short exploration of these issues. This is really just for people who haven't been running around this literature for 10, 15, 20 years, whatever, like many of us in this portion of the room. This is really the, I'm just looking at where, this is multiple ways, this is the issue of underdetermination. Want to say one more thing on this then?
I asked a question, which I don't think, Julian answered, but I don't think anybody else did. That should we even ask a question that which description is more fundamental than the other one? And so I want to ask that question again. That why should we even use that word fundamental? We could have.
I can see in some cases a very good reason, and I take it a lot of Julian's work is meant to do this. Is if you do have a description which you think is as fundamental, it will impose relations on all non-fundamental descriptions. that will tell you it will expose redundancy, for example. So what you want in a fundamental description is that all of the basic elements should be distinct, and that sort of it properly reveal the compositional relation between non-fundamental elements. Am I right?
I
don't know whether this means that a more fundamental theory would contain less law.
Less what?
Law. So, I mean, if we have many, many principles.
Oh, fewer laws.
If a theory has many principles, that means that it's less fundamental. So we try to find an understanding with a minimal set of a law or principles.
Well, that does relate to this question that we avoided earlier about unification, about whether you expect fundamental theories to unify. Is it logically possible for more fundamental laws to proliferate at a lower level? Or is there something that would rule that out? I'm just throwing that out.
Yeah, well, whether that's a psychological consequence or a real thing, I don't know actually. Because we try to understand this. You know, when theory develops, it's developed in direction we understand things better, not worse. But this is psychological pressure of understanding things better than give a direction, the so-called better theory or fundamental theory have a less assumption, less
so that principle. That sort of that runs that says that we're understanding something better if we understand it as part of a unified picture.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Psychological pressure, really.
Well, this touches on the issue of what is the purpose of science? What is it we're trying to achieve? And I think that there are two. One is prediction, and the other one, as Rob was arguing, would be design. But issues of the utility, so to speak, are fundamental or not, seem like they would be intimately wrapped up with Occam's razor and via that towards issues of does it help you predict or does it help you design?
Yeah, maybe. Although, I mean, you know, control is also often cited as a goal of science, and there, explain it, you know, the utility of something in allowing you to control the system. So, you know, basically giving a usable kind of heuristic or equation that allows you to do something might also be.
How do you distinguish design and control?
I'm not sure what is meant by design here. It didn't obviously suggest control.
You're putting something together in a particular way. As I understood it, you're putting something together in a particular way because you want to have a particular effect.
Is that what it meant? I don't know.
You can throw all those things in together, you know, how to control stuff, how to design stuff, how to survive better, all those costs.
Right. I mean, you could run control together with prediction, too, that I predict that if I do this, you know, put these elements together, then they will blow up over Pacific Ocean and destroy this atoll. Right. Yeah.
Begs questions.
Julian and then Chris.
Sorry, but I think there's a very interesting historical development about the understanding of science. The first Greeks who really talked about it, they really were just after understanding, for explanation. I would guess it's with Archimedes that you get the first use of application. Then with Leibniz, you get a fantastic burst. He's amazing, he's everything. He wants to understand, but he also wants to exploit it.
Yeah.
And he's very explicit that he's developing the good notation for the calculus to help us build better machines and improve the quality of life and so forth. So it's a very interesting historical process, I would think, just broadly speaking.
Okay. And then presumably we could go forward and construct different goals and add to or subtract some.
I think this brings up an interesting question that, I mean, from the evolutionary point of view, why are we interested in explaining things? I mean, other than applying those explanations.
Except for having a bit of fun and possibly earning some money, mine is just pure curiosity.
Yeah.
I say that from personal experience.
Curiosity is not fun.
Well, I said that is fun. Yes, all right.
Yeah, but I wonder. I mean, this curiosity that must have been developed. I'm not on one by one basis, but for the human race, that must have been developed because of its applications.
Yeah,
I assume. So,
well, that's to accept the Darwinian thing. I'm not sure that. I don't think the Darwinian is absolutely overarching necessarily.
Isn't there a name for this logical error?
Yeah.
There's a name. What is this called? The something fallacy. This is the fallacy.
Yeah,
it's the fallacy. No, it has to do with the fallacy of origins.
Genetic fallacy.
Genetic fallacy, right. Okay.
In this case, really.
Really. I mean, the idea is, you know, that it's not an explanation of why we play music, that music was an artifact of our, you know, development of language or whatever it was an artifact of.
So the curiosity might have been an artifact.
The fastest way to evolve something is sexual selection. So it might be the science is an epiphenomenon of birds.
We're being very careful. Sexual selection is very, very controversial in population genetics. It's still an open question of why there is any sexual selection, because there are major costs to it. So sexual selection is by no means...
Some kind of selection.
Why it should be, why that actually is a compartment consistent with natural selection, because the cost of you don't, if you're not hermaphroditic, you actually dilute your genome by a factor of 2 every single time, and that has huge costs.
Well, this is controversial. Like, don't construct a better example. I mean, that's the. Do you think there's not an example of what Kevin's.
Oh, I was just saying that there are aspects
that's a weak. Yeah, sure. Yeah. Right. Yeah. More on this?
There's one thing I'd like to. I think explanation has to be there, but also I noticed during the days that there seemed to be a tension between explanation why and explanation how, and I think in philosophy also that generates conflicts that are motivated by latent contextual factors, and there's a kind of a tension between the principle theory.
About whether something is a good explanation.
Well, explanation how, or not good explanation. See, I think when we don't continue with all of the qualifiers, it generates conflict. So there are explanations how and explanations why.
No, I mean, my point was you might say that something's a good explanation how, and somebody might say it's not a good explanation when they meet explanation.
Exactly, yeah, because especially if it's principles versus dynamics, right? Because dynamics really has this kind of how in it, okay? You know, Maxwell said, I want to see the particular goal of it. I think that's a legitimate part of understanding what we're talking about, right? But you don't necessarily get that from a straight-out conservation law. It's just sort of saying, you know, everything has to balance. You sort of want to know, well, why? How is it that it ends up balancing? I can see that it ends up balancing. I can say, yeah, it's explanatory to me that there would be these symmetries, but because why would it be broken in one direction or another? So I don't need reassurance on that, but still, I could want to know, well, how exactly could this funny thing work? You know, that's what I thought that Maxwell was doing with his mechanical model. Mm-hmm. Because when you look at that, I think there's really some kind of kick to that. You know, it wasn't worthless to have done it.
Right. Okay, let's take a stab at 7, which I think is potentially very interesting. Might there be no true, which I guess means universal regularities, and thus perhaps one might say, might there be no laws?
No.
Okay.
Yes,
and then we'll have some. Well,
I think one distinction you want to make there, certainly in right in the first talk, we had the distinction between true regularities and laws came up.
Mm-hmm.
So presumably the question that's meant here is might there be no law-like regularities? I mean, it's trivial that there are going to be regularities of some kind.
I was wondering about that, whether that was a triviality and whether the question really does boil down to one of laws. I'm not sure that that's how that was meant, but I think I edited that.
So
but why don't you expand on that? Yeah. What's the interesting question that you extract?
Yeah, so the interesting question is whether none of the regularities are law-like, whatever it takes to be law-like. And so if what it took to be law-like was something like the best system approach that John told us about in the first session, then it would be that there was no such best system. So for any understanding of what it is to be a law, you can ask that question.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Rephrased it as
if you put the word law in it, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Okay. Otherwise,
it's trivial. Well, I'm not sure it's trivial, but then right. But a Humean might just run those together, right? True.
Every philosopher called Steve
yes.
In this room, it is standing near the board. There's a regularity.
Right. Okay.
Yes. In the world, yes. There are different regularities of that kind.
Yes, so I agree. I think it's got a large degree of how far down, in a certain sense, from my point about using a loaded term, reality is just a huge compendium of events, to use another very, very loaded term. And then the question really becomes, the patterns can be more succinctly described to what degree? Is it all just one extreme?
Well, that's one way of catching that out, right, yeah.
Is it a homomorphism, isomorphism between thoughts and things like
exactly
that?
Exactly so.
Those are non-trivial then.
Exactly so, yeah.
John, you proposed a notion of law, so why don't you take, can you take a shot at this? Good. I'm guessing you would just say yes. It's a purely contingent fact that there are laws.
I would say that, yeah.
Okay.
I think that if my account of what the difference between a law and a different kind of regularity is right, then it might turn out that they're that account is the ones that are laws are the ones that you can exploit to come up with a legitimate measurement method. It might turn out that there aren't any of those, but I think we could never learn that because if we're doing empirical science at all, we've got to be counting on some methods as legitimate ones. So we've all, in order to be in the game at all, you've got to at least provisionally be assuming that you can count on some methods, and my count of laws is right. That means you're at least implicitly assuming that there are some law-like regularity. So it's this weird thing. It's possible that there aren't any laws, but it's not possible if my count of laws is right.
So you get whacked over and over, you get whacked instantly often, but you just keep saying that, like, got it.
Right.
Well, <it's laughs>
that's right. Yeah, well, I was going to add, you might just worry that your data is always sort of parochial and misleading you about what, in fact, laws are. And then you do the inductive move, and you might think, well, the best thing for me to assume is that I haven't been misled and extrapolate wildly and discover whether I have been, right? It's different to say that you'd have positive reason to expect that you're being misleading in that way.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know whether, there's people who want to argue for that, but there's actually, it's not just sort of the inductive risk associated with extrapolating from whatever set of data you have, but that there's actually positive theoretical reasons for thinking that you will be bound to be misled into thinking there are law-like regularities when there aren't.
Right? Wait, what about the pessimistic meta-induction? Or whatever that's called,
Well, I don't think that's a very good argument to begin with, but,
okay. So I'm referring to the observation, just for people who aren't familiar with a bit of jargon, that we've refuted every theory except our current theories. We've refuted a lot of theories in the past, so we don't regard any of them as literally true. So I have no reason to believe, or every reason to believe, that my current theory is not true and no future theories will be true. So it sort of spins the inductive thing around. I mean, you know this. That might be evidence for belief. Somebody who bought that argument might say that I have, I'm not going to, I don't think that there are any true regularities. I've never found one, and why should I ever think I will? Or laws. All right, let me hand it back to John and then Julian and Anthony.
On a different approach to the same question, but last night you were, after the session, you were talking about some ways in which it seems to make a difference to the practice of physics whether something is considered a law or not, because your laws, whether you count something as a law or a nomologically contingent regularity, that's a regularity that's not a law. Makes a difference to how many degrees of freedom you think there are, and that makes a difference to how you set up the state space, which makes a difference to how you do quantization, and might also make a difference to how you do statistical mechanics. So if you want to do any of these applications where you have to describe the state spaces or the phase space of your system, then you need to know what is the range of physically possible ways for this thing to go, state trajectories or whatever. And if you don't have laws, you don't have a principal distinction between the non-actual ones that are physically possible and the non-actual ones that are not physically possible. So it seems to me there's another place where a lot of what goes on in science presumes and can't help presuming that there is a difference between the law-like ones and the ones that aren't law-like. But again, that's not a proof that that distinction is really there.
Right, yeah, fair enough.
There's a social limitation on us.
Right.
Right, because somebody who buys the pessimistic meta-induction is going to give up on the exercise of science, the practice of science, completely. But if they want to buy into it, part of buying into it is buying into some notion. Am I not?
Yeah, that's okay. Right, but right. I'm with Chris on the pessimistic.
Yeah, no, fine. I just threw it out there. I'm like, yeah. Anthony.
Yeah, I guess what I'm wondering about is how deeply, we're so used to the fact that these laws work that we sometimes start to forget what a big clue it is that they're so effective. I mean, I run into this when I teach my undergraduates. I'm teaching an E&M right now, and you know, they're doing circuit problems and stuff, and I tell them, you know, there's an easy way to figure out if you've specified enough information to get the answer for the circuit, which is imagine building the circuit, and if in your imagined circuit something actually happens and there's an answer, then there's enough information. And this is like a revelation to me. You know, it really is, but it's non-trivial that again and again works, that there's this mapping between the real physical system and this thing that happens in idea space, and that we can rely on that again and again to, you know, perform physics, and we're never, we might get the details wrong, but the fact that we can do that exercise and count on it is something we take so much for granted, I think that we forget what a clue it is. Whereas it doesn't work all the time very well in you know, other fields. You know, we do it in physics and we take it for granted, but when we try it in say geology, it is very much less effective. So I guess I'm skeptical the idea that there aren't, you know, we can ask to what degree, you know, we can ask details about whether there are true regularities, but it seems like nature is hitting us in the face again and again with the fact that there are.
Okay, so it's the existence of true regularities that makes that kind of modeling possible.
Yeah,
it's not. I mean, somebody might have said, "Well, the difference is you're thinking, you're asking them to think about little finite subsystems, and they can sort of see what all the elements are, and it's a controlled experiment that you're asking them to envision." And geology, natural selection, very hard to imagine it. So that would be a different way of explaining the same phenomenon.
I think we forget how very difficult it was to discover this method that we take for granted, and how amazing it is that it works. I mean, I have dreams that I'm sure there was no particularly good law-like regularity underlying. You know, reality is not.
Well, just to come in again, I made that point about we were extraordinary lucky with the planets move in circles, and there's an extraordinary property of the empty focus of the orbit too, which Ptolemy discovered. I made that point that our understanding of the motion of the planets has gone through seven major revolutions, and it hasn't invalidated any of the early ones except to say they are valid to a certain accuracy, and that. I think that's the single most impressive example in science is that successive changing of viewpoints when the focus got better and then somebody had a brilliant insight. I mean, there's Hipparchus, there's Ptolemy, there's Copernicus, there's Kepler, there's Newton, there's Einstein. It's just fantastic, and it's these insights. But the wonderful thing is it doesn't destroy what was before there. Nothing goes lost, as my quotation from the mathematics book. It's not only in mathematics that we have nothing goes lost in solid results.
I don't understand nothing, you may have said it, but why has nothing gotten lost in astronomy?
Aristotelian physics got lost. It got overturned.
But it wasn't mathematical. Aristotelian physics was not mathematical.
You could imagine mathematizing it.
Well, nobody tried seriously. I mean, there's this wonderful line in Galileo's Discorsi where he talks about the laws about motion. He says, the books that have been written about motion are neither few nor small. But nobody has yet asked and there's been a lot of discussion about how things fall. But nobody has yet asked precisely how they do fall. Exactly how does the speed build up?
That was the decisive question. Mm-hmm. And that's when science of dynamics on the Earth began.
Okay. Let's... The topic I think we're pulling away from a little bit, but this seems to be... This suggests to me, for instance, again, Lee's and Roberto's talk of it, that the idea that the universe is, which is kind of a very expansive version of a conventional multiverse scenario, that the proposal that lots of different things happen and there's different physics in different places. And then there's the related question about whether you have reason to believe that. There's the kind of epistemological question. But
you're talking about number 8 there, or
what's that?
Seven.
No, I'm talking about number 7, about whether true regularities. I mean, this is one way to think about it anyway. But whether...
Yeah, I'd like to make one comment.
Yeah.
I really like this analog with geology. And so one may wonder why geology lack of a regularity. There is a physical reason, because on Earth, different phases of matter can coexist. That's one thing. Second, all these different phases of matter can be probed by a single entity, photon. So therefore, if using a photon to observe those different things, you'll see a lot of variety, and they appear arbitrarily, the lack of regularity. So one can imagine that if on different phase of matter, one matter you have SU3 QCD, another might have SU5 QCD, they're all different and law. Then if that happens, then apparently the law don't have any regularities. And so we are lucky in the sense that our universe is not like Earth. Our universe is more like inside the sun. Inside the sun, there's only one phase of matter, just plasma. So everything looks the same. And so I think just our universe could be not in the gas state, could be in some kind of like a solid state where all different phases of matter exist, and we can observe cross phase boundary another phase of matter that have different laws. Messy.
I just want to challenge this a little bit. At first, the Earth is part of our universe. I don't know what you mean by saying the universe is like the inside of the sun and not the Earth. Second, I mean, geology does have regularities, right? I mean, this is the
discovery of deep time through the regularity.
Right.
Yeah.
Sure. Maybe the point may be good, but I'm not sure the example.
Yeah. There's a less regularity. You know, there's a way of saying law. We have the law applies to anywhere in the universe. So there's this universality homogeneity in it.
Okay, so
imagine a situation where the different part of the universe have a totally different set of law. I try to say that's totally understandable, just like a different phase of matter have different things. But our universe happen to be one phase, so that's why we think law is so secret. Actually, it don't have to be. Law can be very dirty, and it's just messy, irregular. That's
right. That gets back to Julian's point about homomorphism and isomorphism, just the still issue of, you know, the universe could be an exhaustive list of things that aren't connected. There are some patterns.
Exactly.
And the degree is how far down the actual patterns end up going. And I think the comment is that patterns seem to go. And of course, because induction cannot validate induction, even that statement, given that we're all singletons in time, is somewhat problematic philosophically, that we can even conclude that that in the past we have noticed that our theories work. But even if we take that as a given,
more on this? It's around 3:30. Would anybody like to take up anything related or unrelated? That leaves it wide open.
I have a question.
Kevin and
I was just going to make a comment about what Julian was saying.
Oh, sure.
Nothing being lost as you develop a new theory. And this is totally dependent on the question that you're interested in asking.
You mean about glass making techniques getting lost?
Or I meant with the dynamics, right? As you go from as the revolutions in dynamics and planetary motion. It's totally dependent on which question you want to ask. If you want to go back and ask the old questions, then the previous earlier theory is perfectly relevant, perfectly fine. But if you want to include more details, then you have to go to the newer theory.
Of course, yes.
It has to do with what details do you want to include?
But
why is nature so kind to be hierarchical like that, that when we get a new theory, it so beautifully subsumes and includes the old one? We then use an induction on that to say that that's going to keep happening. Of course, we can't fly, but it's worked so far.
No, I don't think so. That's a little. I think the big counterexample to this. I mean, this does happen a lot, but I think that the Copernican shift from Ptolemaic astronomy is not. Ptolemaic, and Julian may correct me on this, but doesn't look to me like a limit. The Copernican picture.
In a part of science that we can really follow and is mathematical and then why.
Yeah. No, I agree. Yeah.
Good. I'd like to defend you a little bit.
Okay.
I mean, it wasn't just like it was it wasn't just that Ptolemy was a fool. The epicycles were a unified explanation of retrograde motion and the fact that the planet appears closer during the peak of retrograde motion. So that really was a kind of instance of Occam's razor where you would say, oh, there can't be, you know, there's got to be something going on there. This epicycle looks like it's really there.
Right.
And then there was another accident about, you know, gee, there's a funny correlation that I can't explain. But, you know, the Copernican explanation isn't like that at all. He's got a different unified explanation. So the thing that looked like insight in Ptolemy's system was really wrong. And it got flushed.
Mm-hmm. Right. Then the question is that episode an anomaly in the history of science?
Yeah.
And,
Ptolemy's was actually still even better than you say. It was amazingly good. And it actually provided the world and the astronomers and the religious people with perfectly adequate ways of predicting what was going to happen and to a large extent understanding what was happening except for the one ship for 1500 years. So it's not a bad record. And it was very, very good. Let me just mention one other thing, which is there's an extraordinary thing called the equant. There's an amazing phenomenon in this. First of all, the planetary orbits are circled to an unbelievable degree. You can't tell Venus's orbit from a circle, it's one part in 70,000 differing between there. But there's an absolutely amazing thing too, property with the empty focus, which is what Ptolemy discovered, it's called the equant. If you hover at the empty focus of a planetary orbit, you see the planet moving around the ecliptic almost totally uniformly. Exactly to the same accuracy that the circle approximates the ellipse so well, the spoke going around from the empty focus of the planetary orbit will tell you its position. It is absolutely breathtaking. And when you see it illustrated for Mercury, which has an ellipticity of one, eccentricity of one-fifth, you can hardly believe that. My son has done a diagram for me, which I'll get him to put it on my website. You can have a look at it. Just have a look at that, the equant for Mercury. It is just mind-boggling. It is that invisible point that there's empty focus controlling the motion of that planet. And because that equant was so damned useful and so good, first of all, Copernicus couldn't stand it because it wasn't uniform motion. That's why he discovered, hit on the idea of his thing. It went on for ages. It's also the reason why, when he inverted Hipparchus's theory of the solar motion, do you know where he put the center of the solar system? At the empty focus of the Earth's orbit. Full of ironies. And it's Kepler who made it heliocentric, not Copernicus. Copernicus is a theory of mobility. So it was a jolly good bit of work that they did. And the circle, I mean, Kessler and quite distinguished historians of science said, oh, Ptolemy was a bit of an idiot. Why didn't he try this? He'd have done much better. It's the worst thing he could have done.
Yeah.
Way, way below observational levels.
Good. Well, I think we'll wrap things up. If anybody has any questions about pickup or checking out of the hotel room or anything, I'll be around for a little bit. And I'd like to thank PI, if anybody from PI is watching, for funding this, and thank FQXI, and Anthony, you can stand in for FQXI for providing funding also. I think it's been an interesting and enjoyable workshop, and I hope either we or do this again or somebody else kind of picks it up, because I think there's a lot of issues that we've only been able to touch on.
And you should surely thank Holly and Nina.
Yes, and my organizing committee. Right? Yeah. So David and Chris for
helping
organize. No, it was
Holly and Nina.
you're like Holly.
You're the one on camera.
Holly, thank you. Thank you very much. Yes, they've been great. And the guy in the booth, Matthew. Hi, Matthew. Thanks for staying on Saturday of a long weekend. That's it. Thanks a lot. Okay.
Let me, as the oldest, say thank you.